in my work. I walked 3 times around the tree. My heart leaped. It was good. John nodded. Not bad, he pronounced. You'll do. I went to get the ladder from the shed to trim the big bowler hat, and the ladder was gone. The boy I didn't like was in the kitchen garden with the rake. I went up to him, scowling. Where's the ladder? It was the first time I had spoken to him. He ignored my brusqueness and answered me politely. Mr. Digence took it. He's around the front, fixing the roof. I helped myself to one of the cigarettes John had left in the shed and smoked it, sending mean looks to the boy who eyed it enviously. Then I sharpened the pruning shears. Then, liking the sharpening, I sharpened the garden knife, taking my time, doing it well. All the time, behind the rhythm of the stone against the blade, was the rhythm of the boy's rake over the soil. Then I looked at the sun and thought it was getting late to be starting on the large bowler hat. Then I went to find John. The ladder was lying on the ground. Its 2 sections made a crazy clock-hands angle. The metal channel that was supposed to hold them at a constant 6 o'clock had been wrenched from the wood, and great splinters protruded from the gash in the side rail. Beside the ladder lay John. He did not move when I touched his shoulder, but he was warm as the sun that touched his splayed limbs and his blooded hair. He was staring straight up into the clear blue sky, but the blue of his eyes was strangely overcast. The sensible girl deserted me. All of a sudden, I was only myself, just a stupid child, almost nothing at all. What shall I do? I whispered. What shall I do? My voice frightened me. Stretched out on the ground, with John's hand clutched in mine and shards of gravel digging into my temple, I watched time pass. The shadow of the library bay spread across the gravel and reached the farthest rungs of the ladder. Rung after rung, it crept up the ladder toward us. It reached the safety catch. The safety catch. Why had John not checked the safety catch? Surely he would have checked it. Of course he would. But if he did check it, then how... why... It didn't bear thinking about. Rung after rung after rung, the shadow of the bay crept nearer and nearer. It reached John's worsted trousers, then his green shirt, then his hair. How thin his hair had grown. Why had I not taken better care of him? It didn't bear thinking about. Yet how not to think? While I was noticing the whiteness of John's hair, I noticed too the deep grooves cut into the earth by the feet of the ladder as it lurched away from under him. No other signs. Gravel is not sand or snow, or even newly dug earth. It does not hold a footprint. No trace to show how someone might have come. How they might have loitered at the base of the ladder, how, when they had finished what they came for, they calmly walked away. For all the gravel could tell me, it might have been a ghost. Everything was cold. The gravel, John's hand, my heart. I stood up and left John without looking back. I went around the house to the kitchen garden. The boy was still there. He was putting the rake and the broom away. He stopped when he saw me approach, stared at me. And then, when I stopped, "Don't faint! Don't faint!" I told myself. He came running forward to catch me. I watched him as though from a long, long way away. And I didn't faint. Not quite. Instead, when he came close, I felt a voice rise up inside myself, words that I didn't choose to say, but which forced their way out of my strangled throat. Why doesn't anybody help me? He grasped me under my arms. I slumped against him. He helped me gently down to the grass. I'll help you, he said. I will.
With the death of John the Dig still fresh in my mind, the vision of Miss Winter's face, bereft, still dominating my memory, I barely noticed the letter that was waiting for me in my room. I didn't open it until I'd finished my transcription, and when I did, there wasn't much to it. Dear Miss Lee, after all the assistance your father has given me over the years, may I say how glad I am to be able in some small way to return the favour to his daughter. My initial researches in the United Kingdom have revealed no indication of the whereabouts of Miss Hester Barrow after her period of employment at Angelfield. I have found a certain number of documents relating to her life before that period, and I am compiling a report that you should have within a few weeks. My researches are by no means at an end. I have not yet exhausted my investigation of the Italian connection, and it's more than likely that some detail arising from the early years will throw up a new line of inquiry. Do not despair. If your governess can be found, I will find her. Yours sincerely, Emmanuel Drake. I put the letter away in a drawer, then pulled on my coat and gloves. Come on, then, I said to Shadow. He followed me downstairs and outdoors, and we took the path along the side of the house. Here and there a shrub grown against the wall caused the path to drift. Imperceptibly, it led away from the wall, away from the house, to the maze-like enticements of the garden. I resisted its easy curve and continued straight on. Keeping the house wall always on my left meant squeezing behind an ever-widening thicket of densely grown, mature shrubs. Their gnarled stems caught my ankles. I had to wrap my scarf around my face to avoid being scratched. The cat accompanied me so far, then stopped, overwhelmed by the thickness of the undergrowth. I kept going, and I found what I was looking for. A window, almost overgrown with ivy, and with such a denseness of evergreen leaf between it and the garden that the glimmer of light escaping from it would never be noticed. Directly inside the window, Miss Winter's sister sat at a table. Opposite her was Judith. She was spooning mouthfuls of soup between the invalid's raw, patched lips. Suddenly, midway between bowl and mouth, Judith paused and looked directly toward me. She couldn't see me. There was too much ivy. She must have felt the touch of my gaze. After a moment's pause, she turned back to her task and carried on. But not before I noticed something strange about the spoon. It was a silver spoon with an elongated A in the form of a stylized angel ornamenting the handle. I had seen a spoon like that before. A. Angel. Angelfield. Emmeline had a spoon like that. And so did Aurelius. Keeping flat to the wall and with the branches tangling in my hair, I wriggled back out of the shrubbery. The cat watched me as I brushed the bits of broken twig and dead leaves from my sleeves and shoulders. Inside, I suggested, and he was more than happy to concur. Mr. Drake hadn't been able to trace Hester for me. On the other hand, I had found Emmeline. The Eternal Twilight. In my study I transcribed. In the garden I wandered. In my bedroom I stroked the cat and held off my nightmares by staying awake. The moonlit night when I had seen Emmeline appear in the garden seemed like a dream to me now, for the sky had closed in again, and we were immersed once more in the endless twilight. With the deaths of the Misses, and now John the Dig, an additional chill crept into Miss Winter's story. Was it Emmeline, that alarming figure in the garden, who had tampered with the ladder? I could only wait and let the story reveal itself. Meanwhile, with December waxing, the shadow hovering at my window grew always more intense. Her closeness repelled me, her distance broke my heart. Every sight of her evoked in me the familiar combination of fear and longing. I got to the library in advance of Miss Winter. Morning or afternoon or evening, I don't know. They were all the same by now. And stood by the window to wait. My pale sister pressed her fingers to mine, trapped me in her imploring gaze, misted the glass with her cool breath. I had only to break the glass, and I could join her. "Whatever are you looking at?" came Miss Winter's voice behind me. Slowly, I turned. "Sit down," she barked at me. "Then, Judith, put another log on the fire, would you? And then bring this girl something to eat." I sat down. Judith brought cocoa and toast. Miss Winter continued her story while I sipped at the hot cocoa.
"I'll help you," he said. But what could he do? He was just a boy. I got him out of the way. I sent him to fetch Dr. Maudsley, and while he was gone I made strong, sweet tea and drank a potful. I thought hard thoughts, and I thought them quickly. By the time I was at the dregs, the prick of tears had quite retreated from my eyes. It was time for action. By the time the boy returned with the doctor, I was ready. The moment I heard their steps approaching the house, I turned the corner to meet them. "Emmeline, poor child," the doctor exclaimed as he came near, hand outstretched in a sympathetic gesture, as though to embrace me. I took a step back, and he halted. "Emmeline?" In his eyes, uncertainty flared. "Adeline?" It was not possible. It could not be. The name died on his lips. "Forgive me," he stammered. But still he did not know. I did not help him out of his confusion. Instead, I cried. Not real tears. My real tears, and I had plenty of them, believe me, were all stored up. Sometime, tonight, or tomorrow, or sometime soon, I did not exactly know when, I would be alone, and I would cry for hours. For John. For me. I would cry out loud, shrieking my tears, the way I used to cry as a little girl, when only John could soothe me, stroking my hair with hands that smelled of tobacco in the garden. Hot, ugly tears they would be, and when the end came, if it came, my eyes would be so puffed up I would have only red-rimmed slits to see out of. But those were private tears, and not for this man. The tears I gratified him with were fake ones. Ones to set off my green eyes the way diamonds set off emeralds. And it worked. If you dazzle a man with green eyes, he will be so hypnotized that he won't notice there is someone inside the eyes spying on him. "I'm afraid there's nothing I can do for Mr. Digence," he said, rising from beside the body. It was odd to hear John's real name. However did it happen? He looked up at the balustrade where John had been working, then bent over the ladder. Did the safety catch fail? I could look at the corpse without emotion, almost. Might he have slipped? I wondered aloud. Did he grab at the ladder as he fell and bring it down after him? No one saw him fall? Our rooms are at the other side of the house, and the boy was in the vegetable garden. The boy stood slightly apart from us, looking away from the body. There is no family, I seem to remember. He always lived quite alone. I see. And where is your uncle? Why is he not here to meet me? I had no idea what John had told the boy about our situation. I had to play it by ear. With a sob to my voice, I told the doctor that my uncle had gone away. Away? The doctor frowned. The boy did not react. Nothing to surprise him so far, then. He stood looking at his feet, so as not to look at the corpse, and I had time to think him a sissy before going on to say, "My uncle won't be back for a few days." "How many days?" "Oh, now when was it exactly he went away?" I frowned and made a little pretense of counting back the days. Then, allowing my eyes to rest on the corpse, I let my knees quiver. The doctor and the boy both leaped to my side, taking an elbow each. "All right. Later, my dear, later." I permitted them to lead me around the house toward the kitchen door. "I don't know exactly what to do," I said as we rounded the corner. "About what, exactly?"
"The funeral."
"You don't need to do anything. I will arrange the undertakers and the vicar will take care of the rest."
"But what about the money?"
"Your uncle will settle that when he returns. Where is he, by the way?"
"But what if he should be delayed?"
"You think it likely he will be delayed?"
"He's an unpredictable man."
"Indeed." The boy opened the kitchen door, and the doctor guided me in and pulled out a chair. I collapsed into it. "The solicitor will sort out anything that needs doing, if it comes to it. Now, where is your sister? Does she know what's happened?" I didn't bat an eyelid.
"She is sleeping."
"Just as well. Let her sleep, perhaps, eh?" I nodded. "Now, who can look after you while you're on your own here, then?"
"Look after us?"
"You can hardly stay here on your own, not after this. It was rash of your uncle to leave you in the first place, so soon after losing your housekeeper and without finding a replacement. Someone must come."
"Is it really necessary?"
I was all tears and green eyes. Emmeline wasn't the only one who knew how to be womanly. "Well, surely you..."
"It's just that the last time someone came to take care of us... You do remember our governess, don't you?"
And I flashed him a look so mean and so quick, he could hardly believe he'd seen it. He had the grace to blush and looked away. When he looked back, I was nothing but emeralds and diamonds again. The boy cleared his throat. "My grandmother could come and look in, sir. Not to stay, like, but she could come every day, just for a bit." Dr. Maudsley, disconcerted, considered. It was a way out, and he was looking for a way out. "Well, Ambrose, I think that would be the ideal arrangement, in the short term, at least. And no doubt your uncle will be back in a very few days, in which case there will be no need, as you say, to...
"Indeed."
I rose smoothly from my chair.
"So, if you will see to the undertakers, I will see the vicar."
I held out my hand.
"Thank you for coming so quickly."
The man had lost his footing entirely. He rose to his feet at my prompt, and I felt the brief touch of his fingers in mine. They were sweaty. Once again, he searched in my face for my name. Adeline or Emmeline? Emmeline or Adeline? He took the only way out. "I'm sorry about Mr. Digence." "Truly I am, Miss March."
"Thank you, Doctor."
And I hid my smile behind a veil of tears. Dr. Maudsley nodded at the boy on his way out and closed the door behind him. Now for the boy himself. I waited for the doctor to get away, then opened the door and invited the boy to go through it. "By the way," I said, as he reached the threshold, in a voice that showed I was mistress of the house, "there's no need for your grandmother to come in." He gave me a curious look. Here was one who saw the green eyes and the girl inside them. "Just as well," he said, with a casual touch to the brim of his cap, "since I haven't got a grandmother." "I'll help you," he had said. But he was only a boy. He did know how to drive a car, though. The next day he drove us to the solicitor in Banbury, I beside him and Emmeline behind. After a quarter of an hour waiting under the eye of a receptionist, we were finally asked into Mr. Lomax's office. He looked at Emmeline, and he looked at me, and he said, "No need to ask who you two are." "We're in something of a quandary," I explained. "My uncle is absent and our gardener has died. It was an accident, a tragic accident. Since he has no family and has worked for us forever, I do feel the family should pay for the funeral, only we are a little short." His eyes veered from me to Emmeline and back again. "Please excuse my sister. She is not quite well." Emmeline did indeed look odd. I had let her dress in her outmoded finery, and her eyes were too full of beauty to leave room for anything so mundane as intelligence. "Yes," said Mr. Lomax, and he lowered his voice a sympathetic half-tone. "I had heard something to that effect." Responding to his kindness, I leaned over the desk and confided, "And, of course, with my uncle. Well, you've had dealings with him, so you'll know, won't you? Things are not always terribly easy there, either." I offered him my most transparent stare. "In fact, it's a real treat to talk to someone sensible for a change." He turned the rumours he had heard over in his mind. "One of the twins was not quite right," they said. "Well," he concluded, "clearly no flies on the other one." "The pleasure is entirely mutual, miss. Forgive me, but what was your father's name again?" "The name you are after is March, but we have become used to being known by our mother's name, the Angelfield twins, they call us in the village. No one remembers Mr. March, especially us. We never had the chance to meet him, you see, and we have no dealings at all with his family. I have often thought it would be better to change our names formally." "Can be done. Why not? Simple matter, really. But that's for another day. Today's business, of course. Now let me put your mind at rest about this funeral. You don't know when your uncle will be back, I take it." "It may be quite some time," I said, which was not exactly a lie. "It doesn't matter. Either he will be back in time to settle the expenses himself, or if he is not, then I will settle it on his behalf and sort things out when he comes home." I turned my face into the picture of relief he was looking for, and while he was still warm with the pleasure of having been able to take the load off my mind, I plied him with a dozen questions about what would happen if a girl like me, having the responsibility of a sister like mine, should have the misfortune of mislaying her guardian for good. In a few words, he explained the whole situation to me, and I saw clearly the steps I would have to take and how soon I would need to take them. "Not that any of this applies to you in your position," he concluded, as if he had quite run away with himself in painting this alarming scenario, and wished he could take back three-quarters of what he had said. "After all, your uncle will be back with you in a few short days." "God willing," I beamed at him. We were at the door when Mr. Lomax remembered the essential thing. Incidentally, I don't suppose he left an address.
You know my uncle, I thought as much.
You do know approximately where he is, though? I liked Mr. Lomax, but it didn't stop me lying to him when I had to. Lying was second nature to a girl like me.
Yes, that is, no.
He gave me a serious look. Because if you don't know where he is... His mind returned to all the legalities he had just enumerated for me.
Well, I can tell you where he said he was going.
Mr. Lomax looked at me, eyebrows raised.
He said he was going to Peru.
Mr. Lomax's rounded eyes bulged, and his mouth dropped open.
But of course, we both know that's ridiculous, don't we?
I finished.
He can't possibly be in Peru, can he?
And with my most reassured, most pluckily capable smile, I closed the door behind me, leaving Mr. Lomax to worry on my behalf. The day of the funeral came, and still I hadn't had a chance to cry. Every day there had been something. First the vicar, then villagers arriving warily at the door, wanting to know about wreaths and flowers. Even Mrs. Maudsley came, polite but cold, as though I was somehow tainted with Hester's crime.
"Mrs. Proctor, the boy's grandmother, has been a marvel," I told her. "Do thank your husband for suggesting it."
Through it all, I suspected that the Proctor boy was keeping an eye on me, though I could never quite catch him at it. John's funeral wasn't the place to cry, either. It was the very last place. For I was Miss Angelfield, and who was he? Only the gardener. At the end of the service, while the vicar was speaking kindly, uselessly, to Emmeline, would she like to attend church more frequently? God's love was a blessing to all creatures. I listened to Mr. Lomax and Dr. Maudsley, who thought themselves out of earshot behind my back.
"A competent girl," the solicitor said to the doctor. "I don't think she quite realizes the gravity of the situation. You realize no one knows where the uncle is.
But when she does, I've no doubt she'll cope. I've put things in train to sort out the money side of things. She was worried about paying for the gardener's funeral, of all things. A kind heart to go with the wise head on her shoulders."
"Yes," said the doctor weakly.
"I was always under the impression, don't know where it came from, mind you, that the two of them were not quite right. But now I've met them, it's plain as day that it's only the one of them afflicted. A mercy. Of course, you'll have known how it was all along, being their doctor."
The doctor murmured something I did not hear.
"What's that?" the solicitor asked. "Missed, did you say?" There was no answer. Then the solicitor asked another question.
"Which one is which, though? I never did find out when they came to see me. What is the name of the one who is sensible?"
I turned just enough to be able to see them out of the corner of my eye. The doctor was looking at me with the same expression he had had in his eyes during the whole service. Where was the dull-minded child he had kept in his house for several months? The girl who could not lift a spoon to her lips or speak a word of English, let alone give instructions for a funeral and ask intelligent questions of a solicitor. I understood the source of his bafflement. His eyes flickered from me to Emmeline, from Emmeline to me.
"I think it's Adeline." I saw his lips form the name, and I smiled as all his medical theories and experiments came tumbling down about his feet. Catching his eye, I raised my hand to the pair of them. A gracious gesture of thanks to them for coming to the funeral of a man they hardly knew in order to be of service to me. That's what the solicitor took it for. The doctor may have taken it rather differently. Later, many hours later, the funeral over, at last I could cry. Except that I couldn't. My tears, kept in too long, had fossilized. They would have to stay in forever now.
Fossilized tears. "Excuse me," Judith began, and stopped. She pressed her lips tight. Then, with an uncharacteristic flutter of the hands, "The doctor is already out on a call. He won't be here for an hour. Please." I belted my dressing gown and followed. Judith was half running a few paces ahead. We went up and down flights of stairs, turned into passages and corridors, arrived back on the ground floor, but in a part of the house I hadn't seen before. Finally, we came to a series of rooms that I took to be Miss Winter's private suite. We paused before a closed door, and Judith gave me a troubled look. I well understood her anxiety. From behind the door there came deep, inhuman sounds, bellows of pain interrupted by jagged gasps for breath. Judith opened the final door, and we went in. I was astonished. No wonder the noise reverberated so. Unlike the rest of the house, with its overstuffed upholstery, lavish drapes, baffled walls and tapestries, this was a spare and naked little room. The walls were bare plaster, the floor simple boards. A plain bookcase in the corner was stuffed with piles of yellowing paper, and in the corner stood a narrow bed with simple white covers. At the window, a calico curtain hung limply each side of the panes, letting the night in. Slumped over a plain little school desk, with her back to me, was Miss Winter. Gone were her fiery orange and resplendent purple. She was dressed in a white long-sleeve chemise, and she was weeping. The harsh, atonal scraping of air over vocal cords, jarring wails that veered into frighteningly animal moans. Her shoulders heaved and crashed, and her torso shuddered. The force travelled through her frail neck to her head, along her arms into her hands, which jolted against the desktop. Judith hurried to replace a cushion beneath Miss Winter's temple. Miss Winter, utterly possessed by the crisis, seemed not to know we were there. "I've never seen her like this before," Judith said, fingers pressed to her lips, and with a rising note of panic. "I don't know what to do." Miss Winter's mouth gaped and grimaced, contorted into wild, ugly shapes by the grief that was too big for it. "It's all right," I said to Judith. It was an agony I knew. I drew up a chair and sat down beside Miss Winter. "Hush, hush, I know." I placed an arm across her shoulder, drew her two hands into mine. Shrouding her body with my own, I bent my ear close to her head and went on with the incantation. "It's all right. It'll pass. Hush, child. You're not alone." I rocked her and soothed her and never stopped breathing the magic words. They were not my own words, but my father's. Words that I knew would work, because they'd always worked for me. "Hush," I whispered. "I know. It'll pass." The convulsions did not stop, nor the cries become less painful, but they gradually became less violent. She had time between each new paroxysm to take in desperate, shuddering breaths of air. "You're not alone. I'm with you." Eventually, she was quiet. The curve of her skull pressed into my cheek. Wisps of her hair touched my lips. Against my ribs, I could feel her little flutters of breath, the tender convulsions in her lungs. Her hands were very cold in mine. There. There now. We sat in silence for minutes. I pulled the shawl up and arranged it more warmly around her shoulders and tried to rub some warmth into her hands. Her face was ravaged. She could scarcely see out of her swollen eyelids, and her lips were sore and cracked. The birth of a bruise marked the spot where her head had been shaken against the desk. "He was a good man," I said. "A good man. And he loved you." Slowly she nodded. Her mouth quivered. Had she tried to say something? Again her lips moved. The safety catch. Was that what she'd said? Was it your sister who interfered with the safety catch? It seems a brutal question now, but at the time, with that flood of tears having swept all etiquette away, the directness did not feel out of place. My question caused her one last spasm of pain, but when she spoke, she was unequivocal. "Not Emmeline. Not her. Not her." "Who, then?" She squeezed her eyes shut, began to sway, and shook her head from side to side. I've seen the same movement in animals in zoos when they've been driven mad by their captivity. Beginning to fear the renewal of her agony, I remembered what it was that my father used to do to console me when I was a child. Gently, tenderly, I stroked her hair until, soothed, she came to rest her head on my shoulder. Finally, she was quiet enough for Judith to be able to put her to bed. In a sleepy, childlike voice, she asked for me to stay. And so I stayed with her, kneeling by her bedside and watching her fall asleep. From time to time, a shiver disturbed her slumber, and a look of fear came on her sleeping face. When this happened, I smoothed her hair until her eyelids settled back into peace. When was it that my father had consoled me like this? An incident rose out of the depths of my memory. I must have been 12 or so. It was Sunday. Father and I were eating sandwiches by the river when twins appeared. Two blonde girls with their blonde parents, day trippers come to admire the architecture and enjoy the sunshine. Everyone noticed them. They must have been used to the stares of strangers. But not mine. I saw them and my heart leapt. It was like looking into a mirror and seeing myself complete. With what ardor I stared at them, with what hunger. Nervous, they turned away from the girl with a devouring stare and reached for their parents' hands. I saw their fear, and a hard hand squeezed my lungs until the sky went dark. Then, later, in the shop, I on the window seat, between sleep and a nightmare, he crouched on the floor, stroking my hair, murmuring his incantation, "Hush, it will pass. It's all right. You're not alone." Sometime later, Dr. Clifton came. When I turned to see him in the doorway, I got the feeling that he may have been there for some time already. I slipped past him on my way out, and there was something in his expression I didn't know how to read. Underwater cryptography. I returned to my own rooms, my feet moving as slowly as my thoughts. Nothing made sense. Why had John the Dig died? Because someone had interfered with the safety catch on the ladder. It can't have been the boy. Miss Winter's story gave him a clear alibi. While John and his ladder were tumbling from the balustrade through the empty air to the ground, the boy was eyeing her cigarette, not daring to ask for a drag. Then surely it must have been Emmeline. Except that nothing in the story suggests that Emmeline would do such a thing. She was a harmless child. Even Hester said so. And Miss Winter herself couldn't have been clearer. No, not Emmeline. Then who? Isabel was dead. Charlie was gone. I came to my rooms, went in, stood by the window. It was too dark to see. There was only my reflection, a pale shadow you could see the night through. Who? I asked it. At last, I listened to the quiet, persistent voice in my head that I'd been trying to ignore. Adeline. No, I said. Yes, it said. Adeline. It was not possible. The cries of grief for John the Dig were still fresh in my mind. No one could mourn a man like that if she had killed him, could she? No one could murder a man she loved enough to cry those tears for. But the voice in my head recounted episode after episode from the story I knew so well. The violence in the topiary garden, each swipe of the shears a blow to John's heart, the attacks on Emmeline, the hair-pulling, the battering, the biting, the baby removed from the perambulator and left carelessly, to die or to be found. One of the twins was not quite right, they said in the village. I remembered and I wondered. Was it possible? Had the tears I had just witnessed been tears of guilt, tears of remorse? Was it a murderess I'd held in my arms and comforted? Was this the secret Miss Winter had hidden from the world for so long? An unpleasant suspicion revealed itself to me. Was this the point of Miss Winter's story? To make me sympathize with her, exonerate her, forgive her. I shivered. But one thing at least I was sure of. She had loved him. How could it be otherwise? I remembered holding her racked and tormented body against mine and knew that only broken love can cause such despair. I remembered the child Adeline reaching into John's loneliness after the death of the missus, drawing him back to life, by getting him to teach her to prune the topiary. The topiary she had damaged. Oh, perhaps I wasn't sure after all. My eyes roamed over the darkness outside the window. Her fabulous garden. Was it her homage to John the Dig? Her lifelong penitence for the damage she had wrought? I rubbed my tired eyes and knew I ought to go to bed. But I was too tired to sleep. My thoughts, if I did nothing to stop them, would go round in circles all night long. I decided to have a bath. While I waited for the tub to fill, I cast about for something to occupy my mind. A ball of paper, half visible beneath the dressing table, caught my attention. I unfolded it, flattened it out. A row of phonetic script. In the bathroom, with the water thundering in the background, I made a few short-lived attempts at picking some kind of meaning out of my string of symbols. Always, there was that undermining feeling that I hadn't captured Emmeline's utterance quite accurately. I pictured the moonlit garden, the contortions of the witch hazel, the grotesque, urgent face. I heard again the abruptness of Emmeline's voice. But however hard I tried, I couldn't recall the pronouncement itself. I climbed into the bath, leaving the scrap of paper on the edge. The water, warm to my feet, legs, back, felt distinctly cooler against the macula on my side. Eyes closed, I slid right under the surface. Ears, nose, eyes, right to the top of my head. The water rang in my ears. My hair lifted from its roots. I came up for air, then instantly plunged under water again. More air, then water. In a loose, underwater fashion, thoughts began to swim in my mind. I knew enough about twin language to know that it was never totally invented. In the case of Emmeline and Adeline, it would be based on English or French, or could contain elements of both. Air. Water. Introduced distortions, in the intonation maybe, or the vowels, and sometimes extra bits, added to camouflage rather than to carry meaning. Air. Water. A puzzle. A secret code. A cryptograph. It wouldn't be as hard as the Egyptian hieroglyphs, or Mycenaean Linear B. How would you have to go about it? Take each syllable separately. It could be a word, or a part of a word. Remove the intonation first. Play with the stress. Experiment with lengthening, shortening, flattening the vowel sounds. Then what did the syllable suggest in English, in French? And what if you left it out and played with the syllables on either side instead? There would be a vast number of possible combinations. Thousands. But not an infinite number. A computing machine could do it. So could a human brain, given a year or two. The dead go underground. What? I sat bolt upright in shock. The words came to me out of nowhere. They beat painfully in my chest. It was ridiculous. It couldn't be. Trembling, I reached to the edge of the bath where I had left my jottings and drew the paper near to me. Anxiously, I scanned it. My notes, my symbols and signs, my squiggles and dots were gone. They had been sitting in a pool of water and had drowned. I tried once more to remember the sounds as they had come to me under water, but they were wiped from my memory. All I could remember was her fraught, intent face and the five-note sequence she sang as she left. The dead go underground. Words that had arrived fully formed in my mind, leaving no trail behind them. Where had they come from? What tricks had my mind been playing to come up with these words out of nowhere? I didn't actually believe that this was what she had said to me, did I? Come on. Be sensible, I told myself. I reached for the soap and resolved to put my underwater imaginings out of my mind. Hair. At Miss Winter's house, I never looked at the clock. For seconds, I had words. Minutes were lines of pencil script. 11 words to the line, 23 lines to the page was my new chronometry. At regular intervals, I stopped to turn the handle of the pencil sharpener and watch curls of lead-edged wood dangle their way to the waste paper basket. These pauses marked my hours. I was so preoccupied by the story I was hearing, writing, that I had no wish for anything else. My own life, such as it was, had dwindled to nothing. My daytime thoughts and my nighttime dreams were peopled by figures, not from my world, but from Miss Winter's. It was Hester and Emmeline, Isabel and Charlie, who wandered through my imagination, and the place to which my thoughts turned constantly was Angelfield. In truth, I was not unwilling to abdicate my own life. Plunging deep into Miss Winter's story was a way of turning my back on my own. Yet one cannot simply snuff oneself out in that fashion. For all my willed blindness, I couldn't escape the knowledge that it was December. In the back of my mind, on the edge of my sleep, in the margins of the pages I filled so frenetically with script, I was aware that December was counting down the days, and I felt the anniversary crawling closer all the time. On the day after the night of the tears, I didn't see Miss Winter. She stayed in bed, seeing only Judith and Dr. Clifton. This was convenient. I hadn't slept well myself. But the following day, she asked for me. I went to her plain little room and found her in bed. Her eyes seemed to have grown larger in her face. She wore not a trace of makeup. Perhaps her medication was at its peak of effectiveness, for there was a tranquillity about her that seemed new. She didn't smile at me, but when she looked up as I entered, there was kindness in her eyes.
"You don't need your notebook and pencil," she said. "I want you to do something else for me today."
"What?" Judith came in. She spread a sheet on the floor, then brought Miss Winter's chair in from the adjoining room and lifted her into it. In the centre of the sheet she positioned the chair, angling it so that Miss Winter could see out of the window. Then she tucked a towel around Miss Winter's shoulders and spread her mass of orange hair over it. Before she left, she handed me a pair of scissors. "Good luck," she said with a smile. "But what am I supposed to do?" I asked Miss Winter.
"Cut my hair, of course."
"Cut your hair?"
"Yes. Don't look like that. There's nothing to it."
"But I don't know how."
"Just take the scissors and cut," she sighed. "I don't care how you do it. I don't care what it looks like. Just get rid of it."
"But I..."
"Please."
Reluctantly, I took up position behind her.
After 2 days in bed, her hair was a tangle of orange, wiry threads. It was dry to the touch, so dry I almost expected it to crackle, and punctuated with gritty little knots.
"I'd better brush it first." The knots were numerous. Though she spoke not a word of reproach, I felt her flinch at every brush stroke. I put the brush down. It would be kinder to simply cut the knots out. Tentatively, I made the first cut, a few inches off the ends, halfway down her back. The blades sheared cleanly through the hair, and clippings fell to the sheet. "Shorter than that," Miss Winter said mildly. "To here?" I touched her shoulders.
"Shorter."
I took a lock of hair and snipped at it nervously. An orange snake slithered to my feet. And Miss Winter began to speak.
I remember a few days after the funeral, I was in Hester's old room. Not for any special reason. I was just standing there by the window, staring at nothing. My fingers found a little ridge in the curtain, a tear that she had mended. Hester was a very neat needlewoman, but there was a bit of thread that had come loose at the end. And in an idle, rather absent sort of way, I began to worry at it. I had no intention of pulling it. I had no intention of any sort, really. But all of a sudden, there it was, loose in my fingers. The thread, the whole length of it, zigzagged with the memory of the stitches, and the hole in the curtain gaping open. Now it would start to fray. John never liked having Hester at the house. He was glad she went. But the fact remained. If Hester had been there, John would not have been on the roof. If Hester had been there, no one would have meddled with the safety catch. If Hester had been there, that day would have dawned like any other day, and as on any other day, John would have gone about his business in the garden. When the bay window cast its afternoon shadow over the gravel, there would have been no ladder, no rungs, no John sprawled on the ground to be taken in by its chill. The day would have come and gone like any other, and at the end of it John would have gone to bed and slept soundly, without even a dream of falling through the empty air. If Hester had been there. I found that fraying hole in the curtain utterly unbearable.
I had been snipping at Miss Winter's hair all the time she was talking, and when it was level with her earlobes, I stopped. She lifted a hand to her head and felt the length.
"Shorter," she said. I picked up the scissors again and carried on.
The boy still came every day. He dug and weeded and planted and mulched. I suppose he kept coming because of the money he was owed. But when the solicitor gave me some cash, "To keep you going till your uncle gets back," and I paid the boy, he still kept coming. I watched him from the upstairs windows. More than once he looked up in my direction and I jumped out of view. But on one occasion he caught sight of me, and when he did he waved. I did not wave back. Every morning he brought vegetables to the kitchen door, sometimes with a skinned rabbit or a plucked hen, and every afternoon he came to collect the peelings for the compost. He lingered in the doorway, and now that I had paid him, more often than not he had a cigarette between his lips. I had finished John's cigarettes, and it annoyed me that the boy could smoke and I couldn't. I never said a word about it. But one day, shoulder against the door frame, he caught me eyeing the pack of cigarettes in his breast pocket. "Swap you one for a cup of tea," he said. He came into the kitchen. It was the first time he had actually come in since the day John died, and sat in John's chair, elbows on the table. I sat in the chair in the corner where the missus used to sit. We drank our tea in silence and exhaled cigarette smoke that rose upward toward the dingy ceiling in lazy clouds and spirals. When we had taken our last drag and stubbed the cigarettes out on our saucers, he rose without a word, walked out of the kitchen and returned to his work. But the next day, when he knocked with the vegetables, he walked straight in, sat in John's chair, and tossed a cigarette across to me before I had even put the kettle on. We never spoke, but we had our habits. Emmeline, who never rose before lunchtime, sometimes spent the afternoons outdoors looking on as the boy did his work. I scolded her about it. "You're the daughter of the house. He's a gardener, for God's sake, Emmeline." But it made no difference. She would smile her slow smile at anyone who caught her fancy. I watched them closely, mindful of what the missus had told me about men who couldn't see Isabel without wanting to touch her. But the boy showed no indication of wanting to touch Emmeline, though he spoke kindly to her and liked to make her laugh. I couldn't be easy in my mind about it, though. Sometimes, from an upstairs window, I would watch the two of them together. One sunny day I saw her lolling on the grass, head on hand, supported by her elbow. It showed the rise from her waist to her hips. He turned his head to answer something she said, and while he looked at her she rolled onto her back, raised a hand, and brushed a stray lock of hair from her forehead. It was a languorous, sensuous movement that made me think she would not mind if he did touch her. But when the boy had finished what he was saying, he turned his back to Emmeline as though he hadn't seen and continued his work. The next morning we were smoking in the kitchen. I broke our usual silence. "Don't touch Emmeline," I told him. He looked surprised. "I haven't touched Emmeline." "Good. Well, don't." I thought that was that. We both took another drag on our cigarettes, and I prepared to lapse back into silence, but after exhaling he spoke again. "I don't want to touch Emmeline." I heard him. I heard what he said. That curious little intonation. I heard what he meant. I took a drag of my cigarette and didn't look at him. Slowly I exhaled. I didn't look at him. "She's kinder than you are," he said. My cigarette wasn't even half finished, but I stubbed it out. I strode to the kitchen door and flung it open. In the doorway, he paused, level with me. I stood stiffly, staring straight ahead at the buttons on his shirt. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down as he swallowed. His voice was a murmur. "Be kind, Adeline." Stung to anger, I lifted my eyes up, meaning to fire daggers at him. But I was startled by the tenderness in his face. For a moment I was confused. He took advantage, raised his hand, was about to stroke my cheek. But I was quicker. I raised my fist, lashed his hand away. I didn't hurt him. I couldn't have hurt him. But he looked bewildered, disappointed. And then he was gone. The kitchen was very empty after that. The missus was gone, John was gone. Now even the boy was gone. "I'll help you," he had said. But it was impossible. How could a boy like him help me? How could anybody help me?
The sheet was covered in orange hair. I was walking on hair, and hair was stuck to my shoes. All the old dye had been cut away. The sparse tufts that clung to Miss Winter's scalp were pure white. I took the towel away and blew the stray bits of hair from the back of her neck. "Give me the mirror," Miss Winter said. I handed her the looking-glass. With her hair shorn, she looked like a grizzled child. She stared at the glass. Her eyes met her own, naked and sombre, and she looked at herself for a long time. Then she put the mirror, glass side down, on the table. "That is exactly what I wanted. Thank you, Margaret." I left her, and when I went back to my room, I thought about the boy. I thought about him and Adeline, and I thought about him and Emmeline. Then I thought about Aurelius, found as an infant, wearing an old-fashioned garment and wrapped in a satchel, with a spoon from Angelfield and a page of Jane Eyre. I thought about it all at length, but for all my thinking, I didn't arrive at any conclusion. One thing did occur to me, though, in one of those unfathomable side steps of the mind. I remembered what it was Aurelius had said the last time I was at Angelfield. I just wished there was someone to tell me the truth. And I found its echo. Tell me the truth. The boy in the brown suit. Now that would explain why the Banbury Herald had no record of the interview their young reporter had gone to Yorkshire for. He wasn't a reporter at all. It was Aurelius all along. Rain and Cake. The next day I woke to it. Today, today, today. A tolling bell only I could hear. The twilight seemed to have penetrated my soul. I felt an unearthly weariness. My birthday. My death day. Judith brought a card from my father with the breakfast tray. A picture of flowers, his habitual vaguely worded greetings, and a note. He hoped I was well. He was well. He had some books for me. Should he send them? My mother had not signed the card. He'd signed it for both of them. Love from Dad and Mother. It was all wrong. I knew it, and he knew it. But what could anyone do? Judith came. "Miss Winter says would now..." I slid the card under my pillow before she could see it. "Now would be fine," I said, and picked up my pencil and pad. "Have you been sleeping well?" Miss Winter wanted to know. "And then, you look a little pale."
You don't eat enough.
I'm fine, I assured her, though I wasn't. All morning I struggled with the sensation of stray wisps of one world seeping through the cracks of another. Do you know the feeling when you start reading a new book before the membrane of the last one has had time to close behind you? You leave the previous book with ideas and themes, characters even, caught in the fibres of your clothes, and when you open the new book, they're still with you. Well, it was like that. All day I had been preyed to distractions, thoughts, memories, feelings, irrelevant fragments of my own life, playing havoc with my concentration. Miss Winter was telling me about something when she interrupted herself.
"Are you listening to me, Miss Lee?"
I jerked out of my reverie and fumbled for an answer. Had I been listening? I had no idea. At that moment I couldn't have told her what she'd been saying, though I'm sure that somewhere in my mind there was a place where it was all recorded. But at the point when she jerked me out of myself, I was in a kind of no-man's land, a place between places. The mind plays all sorts of tricks, gets up to all kinds of things, while we ourselves are slumbering in a white zone that looks for all the world like inattention to the onlooker. Lost for words, I stared at her for a minute, while she grew more and more irritated. Then I plucked at the first coherent sentence that presented itself to me. "Have you ever had a child, Miss Winter?"
"Good Lord, what a question. Of course I haven't. Have you gone mad, girl?"
"Emmeline, then."
"We have an agreement, do we not? No questions?"
And then, changing her expression, she bent forward and scrutinized me closely.
"Are you ill?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Well, you're clearly not in your right mind for work."
It was a dismissal. Back in my room, I spent an hour